Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, October 13th, 2021. President Joe Biden with some steps designed to ease delays in the global supply chain, mostly due to the lingering effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, and that's hampering economic recovery. Those steps including an agreement to have a second key West Coast port run 24/7 and commitments from big retail and shipping companies for more hours of operations. Biden administration planning to reopen the U.S. borders with Canada and Mexico to non-essential travel for fully vaccinated people. We'll get reaction from a New York congressman whose district borders Canada has been pushing for this for a while. The head of the Transportation Security Administration says a new screening area at Reagan Airport in Washington, D.C. will increase security and passenger comfort because it was part of the design from the beginning, not retrofitted like so many airports were after the 9/11 attacks in 2001. And actor William Shatner, also known as Star Trek's Captain Kirk, saying that he is in awe by what he saw and experienced as a real astronaut today. This from CNN Business, the U.S. government stepping up its efforts to relieve the supply chain nightmare that has led to shortages of some goods, higher prices for consumers, and now threatens to slow the economic recovery. The White House will work with companies and ports on a 90-day sprint to alleviate bottlenecks. Some will start working 24/7 to address the backlogs. President Biden with some details today from the White House East Room, first on one of those ports.
Los Angeles and Long Beach are home to two of the largest ports in America, and together these ports are among the largest in the world. And the best way to make that point is that 40% of shipping containers that we import into this country come through these two ports. And today we have some good news. They're going to help speed up the delivery of goods all across America. After weeks of negotiation and working with my team, and with the major union retailers and freight movers, the Port of Los Angeles announced today that it's going to begin operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This follows the Port of Long Beach's commitment to 24/7 that it announced just weeks ago. 24/7 system, what most of the leading countries in the world already operate on now, except us, until now. This is the first key step toward moving our entire freight, transportation, and logistical supply chain nationwide to a 24/7 system. And here's why it matters. Traditionally, our ports have only been open during the week, Monday through Friday, and they're generally closed down at nights and on weekends. By staying open 7 days a week, through the night and on the weekends, the Port of Los Angeles will open over 60 extra hours a week will be open. In total, that will almost double the number of hours that the port is open for business from earlier this year. That means an increase in the hours for workers to be moving cargo off ships onto trucks and rail cars to get to their destination. And more than that, the night hours are critical for increasing the movement of goods because highways are less crowded in the evening, at night. In fact, during off-peak hours in Los Angeles, cargo leaves the port at a 25% faster pace than during the day shift. So by increasing the number of late night hours of operation and opening up for less crowded hours when the goods can move faster, today's announcement has the potential to be a game changer.
President Biden at the White House, he also said if the private sector doesn't step up and increase its operations, we're to call them out and ask them to act. But today, he said, a couple of big companies have agreed to make some changes.
Today, Walmart, our nation's largest retailer, is committing to go all in on moving its products 24/7 from the ports to their stores nationwide. Specifically, Walmart is committing as much as a 50% increase in the use of off-peak hours over the next several weeks. Additionally, FedEx and UPS, two of our nation's biggest freight movers, are committing today to significantly increase the amount of goods they're moving at night. FedEx and UPS are the shippers for some of our nation's largest stores, but they also ship for tens of thousands of small businesses all across America. Their commitment to go all in on 24/7 operations means that businesses of all sizes will get their goods on shelves faster and more reliably. Accordingly, according to one estimate, together, FedEx and UPS alone move up to 40% of packages in America, up to 40%. And other companies are stepping up as well. They include Target, Home Depot, and Samsung, that have all committed to ramp up their activities to utilize off-peak hours at the ports.
President Biden at the White House. And with more on the global supply chain issue, we're joined by Tonya Garcia, reporter at MarketWatch. How much of what President Biden announced today will help this situation?
Well, anything will help, right? It's a situation that a lot of companies are trying to handle on their own. And, anything that, can help them with any of the bottlenecks, help them with any of the issues that they're facing will be appreciated, I'm sure.
What specifically can be done? The government or the businesses, what steps should they be taking?
Point, the goal is for flexibility. One of the problems that has gotten us into the situation that we're in is that the supply chain was kind of rigid. Things happened when they happened, as they were supposed to happen. And when something else happens that throws a monkey wrench, then these systems find themselves completely incapable of moving to accommodate the new situation. So, it is an all hands on deck situation that we have right now. And so, that's why you see these large retailers doing what they're doing in terms of, leasing ships or moving to different ports. And that's why the president and the government felt as though they needed to intervene as well.
And you say that when something happens, is that something the COVID-19 pandemic, or were there other issues that popped up?
Well, COVID-19 definitely is the largest root problem of all of this. But then it's all the things that happen because of it, right? So, you have someone that tests positive on a ship, for instance, which is what happened with Dollar Tree. And then that ship has to turn around, go back. It takes 2 months now. A two-month delay has now occurred. Or you have in Vietnam, you have manufacturing facilities that had to shut down because of the spread of the pandemic. And now, there's no goods that are being produced in those facilities, and that creates a backup. So there's a lot of things that, it's COVID at the base, but then it reveals where all of those aforementioned inflexibilities are.
What are the short-term and long-term consequences of having a supply chain that is having these problems?
On the short term, and this is, the big issue at hand is the holidays. So we have the holiday shopping season coming. Demand is going up. And you have all of these goods that are still in transit. They're not in places where they can get into the hands of consumers. In the long term, experts are saying that there's going to be a reconsideration of how the supply chain is built. Perhaps there will be, for instance, instead of everything coming in through, a couple of major ports, maybe other ports will be used. You have some companies like Levi's that said even before COVID-19, they decided to spread their supply chain across a number of different countries so that if something happens in one place, they have another place that's still producing their goods. These are the sorts of things that a lot of companies, a lot of retailers, and a lot of brands will be considering going forward.
We're talking with Tonya Garcia from MarketWatch. A final question. Is this an issue that lends itself to international solutions? The U.S. is taking some steps, but is it advisable for countries to get together and come up with some joint solutions?
That's a tricky one. It really depends on kind of what comes of all of this. On the one hand, and this is why I say it's tricky, because it's a lot of companies that are competing with one another that are dealing with this issue right now. So going back to this idea of the big retailers that have the deep pockets and can lease their own ships. These are things that they're doing, you know, for themselves. You know, it's not something that's being done, you know, in order to, you know, help, you know, let's say an entire category or an entire industry, even if there is a knock-on effect that will, you know, positively impact some companies or what have you. And so because these are individual companies that are competing with one another, you know, that might throw a monkey wrench in anything that could be done, you know, across the board. But then again, you know, governments and companies get very creative when these sorts of, crazy global situations happen. We've had to get very creative throughout COVID-19, and we'll probably have to continue to be creative, you know, for the coming months. So it's not completely out of the realm of possibility that we'll see some bigger changes besides those that are made on an individual basis.
Tonya Garcia is a reporter with MarketWatch. Find her stories at marketwatch.com and on Twitter at TGarciaNYC. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with more on supply chain troubles and how that might affect the busy holiday shopping and shipping season, questions today to the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
On the supply chain issue, Secretary Buttigieg is saying that there may be challenges for last-minute shoppers among them. Secretary Yellen says there could be isolated shortages of goods in the coming months. So can you give us a realistic breakdown of what Americans could be facing on these shortages come the holiday season? What are we talking about?
For shipment of goods, which I assume is what you're asking about. So the reason that the president has been working so hard for months, long before the last few weeks, to address supply chain issues is because he knew they were multifaceted and that they were impacting a lot of different industries. I know you're asking about shipments and the shipment and movement of goods. And obviously the announcement today related to the ports is a reflection of action taken by the president, by this administration to have an immediate impact. Obviously, there's more that we will continue to press to be done as we're looking to increase the shipment of goods moving more quickly. That's one of the bottlenecks in the supply chain that will help address those concerns people have. Look, I can't make a prediction for you that we're going to solve every issue tomorrow and next week. We're not. We're coming out of an economic crisis caused by a pandemic. But what we are doing is working to using every tool at our disposal to ease the impact on the American people, ease the impact on families as we look to the holidays, but certainly beyond that.
But should Americans expect that this will get worse before it gets better?
I'm not going to make a prediction of that from here. We know there are a number of issues that impact the supply chain, and I don't want to make a prediction because it's not just one issue. Certainly, increasing the capacity at ports, and increasing the number of hours will have a positive impact. There's no question about that. But there are other issues that impact the global supply chain, including the pandemic, something that we are working 24 hours a day to help address. Around the world, that's impacted manufacturing in some countries, manufacturing of goods in some places, and reducing the supply in some places. That's one of the factors, too. We're also working to address that. It's not just one issue, but certainly we're going to use every lever at our disposal to address it, to make it, to address the bottlenecks as quickly as we can. Go ahead.
Let me ask that a slightly similar but different way.
Sure.
Based on everything being announced today,
can
this administration guarantee that holiday packages will arrive on time?
We are not the Postal Service or UPS or FedEx. We cannot guarantee. What we can do is use every lever at the federal government disposal to reduce delays, to ensure that we are addressing bottlenecks in the system, including ports and the need for them to be open longer hours so that goods can arrive. And we can continue to press not only workers and unions, but also companies to take as many steps as they can to reduce these delays.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki during her daily briefing in the White House briefing room with reporters. Labor Department says inflation from August to September rose another 0.4%, prices going up on new cars, food, gas, restaurant meals, and more. costs now compared to this time last year higher overall 5.4%. Inflation, though, means that millions of retirees on Social Security will be getting an increase in benefits in 2022 of 5.9%. That's the largest cost of living adjustment in 39 years for Social Security. Average beneficiary, for that person, it means an extra $92 per month. On Wall Street today, the Dow down a fraction, NASDAQ up 105, S&P up 13. The White House COVID-19 response coordinator, Jeff Zients, pointing to a 20 percentage point increase in vaccination rates as evidence that the Biden administration's vaccine mandates are working. Jeff Zients led off today's virtual briefing.
As of today, 77% of eligible Americans, those 12 and older, have gotten at least their first shot. And thanks to the president's leadership on vaccination requirements, we continue to make important progress. More than 3,500 organizations, from healthcare systems to educational institutions to state and local governments to private businesses, have already stepped up to adopt vaccination requirements. These vaccination requirements have increased vaccination rates by 20 plus percentage points, with organizations routinely seeing their share of fully vaccinated workers rise above 90%. On Monday, Washington State announced that more than 90% of state employees are now fully vaccinated. That's up from around 49% just 5 weeks ago, with more people getting vaccinated each day ahead of the state's October 18th deadline. And importantly, since late July, when the president first announced vaccination requirements and called on organizations to follow his lead, the number of eligible Americans who are unvaccinated has decreased by about one-third, from 97 million down to 66 million individuals. Every day, there's stronger evidence that vaccination requirements are working. They're driving up vaccination rates.
Jeff Zients is the White House COVID-19 response coordinator. NBC News reporting that the Labor Department regulations for President Biden's vaccine mandate for private employers with 100 more workers could be finalized as early as next week. It's now with the Office of Management and Budget in the White House for review. NBC citing an unnamed person familiar with the process. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, part of this briefing, she's the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, saying the seven-day average of daily COVID-19 cases in the U.S. falling 12% from last week, and the seven-day average of daily deaths down 5%. And also at the briefing, a question about vaccines and airline pilots. This past weekend, Southwest Airlines canceled more than 2,000 flights, saying it was due to bad weather and operational issues. But as Newsweek puts it, online rumors spread that the problems were actually the result of pilots protesting and walking out due to Southwest's vaccine mandate. Here's the question answered by Dr. Anthony Fauci, the top White House science advisor, and Dr. Vivek Murthy, U.S. Surgeon General.
I have a question about airline pilots. Commercial airline pilots are held to pretty high physical fitness standards. They undergo medical evaluation every 6 months to maintain their medical certificate to fly. And pilots at American and Southwest Airlines in particular are arguing that some pilots may be reluctant to get vaccinated because of concerns about potential for career-ending side effects. They note that, you know, the FAA's federal air surgeon has ordered pilots not to fly for 48 hours after each shot because of the immediate side effects. They're concerned there could be long-term side effects that could cause them to then lose their medical certification and thus lose their jobs and their livelihood. So is this a valid concern? What are the potential long-term side effects, if any, if a pilot is vaccinated?
Let me turn to Dr. Fauci about the safety and effectiveness of the vaccines. Dr. Fauci?
Thank you, Jeff. Well, right now, on the basis of literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of vaccinations that we've had, the safety of these vaccines have been clearly established. When you look at immediate reactogenicity, that's what the airlines are talking about not having a person fly for, I believe, 24 to 48 hours after, because we do know that it is not uncommon to get a sore arm or to maybe get a low-grade fever or some aches that almost invariably diminish and dissipate over a period of a couple of days. The long-term effects that the people are apparently concerned about really have with I'm sure there is a very, 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 very rare exception, but the long-term effects are really essentially non-existent in the sense of anything that has been a red flag on the part of the follow-up of these individuals. So although one, I guess, can theoretically say, I'm concerned about a long-term effect, the fact of the safety and the follow-up over now, over a considerable period of time, almost a year in so many individuals, we have just not seen that. So we don't really see any true basis in that concern.
And Jeff, if I could just add also, exactly, totally agree with what Dr. Fauci said. I would also note that serious side effects with the vaccines are very rare. We have a lot of data to show that. But consider the alternative. If pilots get COVID-19, the consequences to their health can be significant. The more we've learned about COVID, we've learned that it not only impacts the lungs, but it can impact the nervous system, the cardiovascular system. It can impact the kidneys. It can impact many systems in our body. This is a serious infection. So the best way to protect yourself against long-term health consequences is actually to get vaccinated.
U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy and Dr. Anthony Fauci, who leads the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, part of today's White House COVID-19 response briefing. COVID-related border crossing restrictions at the northern and southern U.S. borders are being lifted for the first time in over a year and a half. The Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas announcing late Tuesday night that starting in November, he didn't say exactly which day, discretionary travelers from Canada and Mexico who are fully vaccinated will be allowed to enter the U.S. by land and by ferry. More than 80% of Canadians 12 years and older are fully vaccinated. It's one of the highest rates in the world. In Mexico, less than 40% of their citizens are fully vaccinated. U.S. Congressman Brian Higgins, a Democrat from New York, a district that includes Buffalo and Niagara Falls along the Canadian border, telling reporters today he's been pushing for this change for a long time.
The White House announced late yesterday that the U.S. border will be open to our Canadian neighbors in the north with a date specific to be determined hopefully today. We're pushing for a November 1st. This border should have been open several months ago, at least consistent with the Canadian border being opened to United States citizens. Just give you one statistics that I think is very, very compelling. Pre-pandemic in 2019, 21 million Canadians visited the United States and spent $21 billion. Obviously, when the pandemic hit and there were restrictions on the border imposed in March of 2020, extending through 19 months, obviously the economies of both the United States and Canada, Western New York and Southern Ontario have taken a major hit. So all of those losses now have the potential to be gains, and we want to move as quickly as possible. This opening will be done in two phases. One will start, again, sometime in November with allowing Canadians who are fully vaccinated to travel into the United States without a testing requirement. The problem with that is they may be reluctant to take that trip because upon their return to Canada, the Canadian government does have a vaccine, a testing requirement. They have both a vaccine and a testing requirement. So we believe, and I will be urging the Canadian federal government to take a look at that and go with the U.S. model, which provides for only fully vaccinated could pass into the United States and hopefully back into Canada.
Congressman Brian Higgins from New York State, he chairs the Canada-U.S. Interparliamentary Group and also the Northern Border Caucus. Canada, by the way, has been allowing fully vaccinated U.S. visitors since August 9th. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now app or wherever you get your podcasts. An article at Stars and Stripes, U.S. military veterans need tools to help them identify and resist increasing recruiting efforts by violent extremist groups, expert witnesses told the House Veterans Affairs Committee on Wednesday. The hearing comes in the months after the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol by some of former President Donald Trump's backers who sought to prevent Congress from certifying President Joe Biden's November election victory. The mob included members of several right-wing and anti-government groups. One of the witnesses at today's hearing, retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Joe Plensler.
For decades, violent extremist groups have sought to infiltrate our military to gain tactical training and access to weapons and explosives. They have also recruited veterans because of their military skills, leadership, and ability to organize. They specifically target the isolated, the impoverished veterans who are frustrated and confused, those who are struggling to adapt to the civilian world. They provide them with a tribe, a simplistic view of the world and its problems, actionable solutions, and a sense of purpose. And then they feed these vulnerable individuals a concoction of lies, an unrelenting narrative of political and social grievance. And they've been successful. Security experts are increasingly concerned about the rising participation of law enforcement members, active duty and reserve service members, and veterans within the ranks of these violent extremist groups. Veterans have been connected in 10% of all domestic terrorist attacks since 2015. This is shocking since veterans only comprise less than 6% of the population. While veterans who participate in domestic terrorism may be few, they can be extremely dangerous. For instance, it only took one by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald, a Marine veteran, to stun a nation and change the history of the presidency. It only took two Army veterans by the names of Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols to destroy the federal building in Oklahoma City and kill 168 people and wound hundreds more. And just this past January, an insurrectionist mob engaging in seditious conspiracy and led in part by violent extremist groups, invaded this house and despoiled the very altar of our democratic republic. They breached the security of this building and hunted. They hunted for you.
Joe Plensler, retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel, one of the witnesses before the House Veterans Affairs Committee today. Another paragraph from the Stars and Stripes news story on today's hearing. Republicans attacked both Democrats on the panel and some of the expert witnesses during the hearing, repeatedly calling on them to characterize left-wing groups such as Antifa and Black Lives Matter as equally responsible for violence in the United States as right-wing militias. Here's one of those exchanges. Congressman Jim Banks is a Republican from Indiana, questioning witness Jeremy Butler, CEO of the group Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America.
Mr. Chairman, I hope every veteran in America is watching this hearing today and hearing from you and the majority party in control of this committee that our veterans are so stupid and susceptible to becoming domestic terrorists that you and the Democrats have to save them from it. It's wildly offensive and dangerous. I wish we were talking about a lot of other issues like the rise in veteran suicide and other issues affecting our veterans, but here we go again. On June 21st, 2020, President Biden released his national strategy for countering domestic terrorism. This strategy rightfully calls out domestic violent terrorists animated by racist values and those who seek to intimidate individuals using the threat of violence. What this strategy doesn't do, however, is name any one of the violent leftist extremist groups who terrorized our cities last summer. Antifa, Black Lives Matter, and other political organizations caused up to $2 billion in damage across the nation and have had little pushback from this current administration. Mr. Butler, according to President Biden's definition of extremism, even the chairman's own definition of a propensity for violence, should Antifa and Black Lives Matter be included in the White House's definition of domestic extremism?
Thanks for the question, sir. I think this is kind of going back to the comments that I was making in my opening statement, which I feel like we are trying to score political points over focusing on the issue at hand. And I appreciate your question, but I'm not going to specifically answer it because I don't think it's helpful. I think what we need to focus on are the issues that our veterans are identifying and that we're identifying that need to be addressed.
Mr. Butler, are you aware of any steps that the White House is taking to address far-left extremism?
I don't work at the White House. I run Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, so my focus is on our members, our constituents, and veterans throughout the country.
CEO of that group, Jeremy Butler, questioned by Congressman Jim Banks of Indiana during today's House Veterans Affairs Committee hearing. The committee chair, Mark DeCano, Democrat from California, saying he called the hearing to try to find ways to provide support for veterans so they don't get drawn into domestic violence groups. You can find the video of the hearing in its entirety at our archive, cspan.org. From the Washington Post, the public got its first look Wednesday at new security checkpoints set to open next month at Reagan National Airport, an upgrade that officials hope will speed screening times and ease congestion in a time for the holiday travel season. 20 years ago, the September 11th attacks changed how people navigate air travel, but airports at the time were not designed to accommodate the more stringent security screening requirements put in place in the aftermath of the attacks, leaving authorities scrambling to find space for TSA checkpoints and personnel. That from the Washington Post. Here's some remarks from the dedication ceremony today. The head of the Transportation Security Administration, David Pakosky.
So as we approach our 20th anniversary, it's good to be here, having been here in Washington, D.C. on 9/11, hoping this airport would reopen, knowing that the airport was relatively new at that point in time, to see now, almost 20 years later, that we have purpose-built security checkpoints here and a purpose-built concourse, which is really important for us. I mean, oftentimes you think of TSA as working in the screening checkpoints, but we truly work around the entire airport. And to build in and design security into a new concourse, limited access points, better lines of sight, better monitoring, really improves security overall. These new two 50,000 square foot each screening checkpoints increase the screening capacity from 20 to 23 with additional capacity for five more. And so if you think about the capacity improvement potential there, it's about a 40% increase in capacity. I love that. I mean, that really makes sure that we can do our level best to provide world-class security to passengers that come through this airport and world-class passenger experience for them while they're here. Each of the checkpoints will include ample space for travelers, and one of the challenges we always had at airports where we built in checkpoints to existing infrastructure was sometimes the area that was left for passengers to recompose, to collect their belongings before they went into the concourse was very short, and it is short here in some locations. So this provides much better room. But the key thing that I would emphasize to everyone here today is the opening of these new checkpoints does two key things for us collectively as travelers. One, it significantly improves the security we will be able to provide. And secondly, it enhances the passenger experience, and that's critically important. So all the new technology that you're going to see in this checkpoint, from the time you begin the screening process until the time you end, results in much better security and much better passenger experience. For example, in identity verification, that's much quicker, and we will gradually eliminate the need for a boarding pass for TSA screening purposes because we have all of a passenger's flight information electronically. With carry-on bag x-ray systems, we can see more inside the bag than we could ever see before based on new technology, which for a passenger means fewer things need to come out of the bag. Really important from a convenience perspective and also really important from a health perspective. One of the things we saw in COVID-19 was the extent that we could reduce contact between a passenger and a passenger's belonging and the screening process, the better. And then one of the new improvements that I'm most excited about is better on-person screening. The net result of all this will be we will reduce the need for pat-downs by a significant amount. And that's going to be welcome news to my officers and certainly welcome news to passengers.
TSA Administrator David Pakosky at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport, the new screening area and concourse, part of a $1 billion project paid for through bonds and airline passenger fees. Also attending today's ceremony, the governor of Virginia, several members of Congress from Virginia, and the mayor of Washington, D.C. The Supreme Court sounded ready Wednesday to reinstate the death penalty for convicted Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, writes the Associated Press. In more than 90 minutes of arguments, the court's six conservative justices seem likely to embrace the Biden administration's argument that a federal appeals court mistakenly threw out Tsarnaev's death sentence for his role in the bombing that killed three people near the finish line of the marathon in 2013. But the AP story also has this. Justice Amy Coney Barrett was the only member of the court to raise the administration's pursuit of a capital sentence for Tsarnaev, even as it halted federal executions. And President Joe Biden has also called for an end to the federal death penalty. Here is that exchange.
Mr. Fagan, I'm wondering what the government's end game is here. So the government has declared a moratorium on executions, but you're here defending his death sentences. And if you win, presumably that means that he is relegated to living under threat of a death sentence that the government doesn't plan to carry out. So I'm just having trouble following the point.
Well, Your Honor, the administration continues to believe the jury imposed a sound verdict and that the Court of Appeals was wrong to upset that verdict. If the verdict were to be reinstated eventually, which will require some further proceedings on remand, there'd then be a round of collateral review, some time for reviewing any clemency petitions. Within that time, the Attorney General presumably can review the matters that are currently under review, such as the current execution protocol. And what we are asking here is that the sound judgment of 12 of respondents' peers that he warrants capital punishment for his personal acts in murdering and maiming scores of innocents, and along with his brother, hundreds of innocents at the finish line of the Boston Marathon should be respected.
Thank you.
Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett questioning U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Eric Fagan, part of today's oral argument in the case United States v. Tsarnaev. The main issues are whether Dzhokhar Tsarnaev received a fair trial because potential evidence was not allowed and potential juror bias was not considered. Secretary of State Antony Blinken meeting in Washington with the foreign ministers of Israel and United Arab Emirates, UAE, today. Joint news conference, Secretary Blinken asked about Iran and its nuclear program and how much longer the U.S. will pursue getting Iran to rejoin the nuclear pact with world powers known as JCPOA.
We're united in the proposition that Iran cannot be allowed to acquire a nuclear weapon, and President Biden is committed to that proposition. We believe that the diplomatic path is the most effective way to ensure that that doesn't happen. But as we've had occasion to discuss in recent weeks, despite the fact that we've made abundantly clear over the last 9 months that we are prepared to return to full compliance with the JCPOA if Iran does the same, what we are seeing, or maybe more accurately not seeing, from Tehran now suggests that that they're not. And time is running short because, as we've also had an opportunity to discuss together, we are getting closer to a point at which returning to compliance with the JCPOA will not, in and of itself, recapture the benefits of the JCPOA. And that's because Iran has been using this time to advance its nuclear program in a variety of ways, including enriching uranium to 20% and even 60%, using more advanced centrifuges, acquiring more knowledge. And so that runway is getting shorter. I'm not going to put a specific date on it, but with every passing day and Iran's refusal to engage in good faith, the runway gets short.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The Times of Israel writing that Blinken saying we will continue to look at every option to deal with the challenge that is posed by Iran. And also at this news conference, the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid saying other options are going to be on the table if diplomacy fails. The Times of Israel writing that hinted at the possibility of military action against Iran if Iran does not return to the 2015 nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Former Congressman Dale Kildee, Democrat of Michigan, has died. He served 36 years in the House from 1976 through 2012. He took part in the 1978 debate whether to televise the U.S. House of Representatives. And a number of years ago, he spoke to C-SPAN about why televising was a good thing.
But one of the positive things about this is that people really are involved in and understand the legislative process like never before, and are very much involved in the national debate. I know that because if I give a speech in the House floor and I come back to my office, very often the phones are ringing off the hook, both in my Washington office and in my offices back home. Case in point was on the war, the Iraqi war. I asked the president 5 questions about the war. By the time I got back to my office, my phones were ringing off the hook, some disagreeing with me, some agreeing with me. but they were involved in the legislative process in real time, and some answering my five questions. And this is very, very important, very, very good for our democracy.
Former Congressman Dale Kildee on the debate to allow cameras in the U.S. House chamber. Again, that was C-SPAN's interview from a number of years ago when he was still a congressman. The allowing of the cameras was approved in 1979. C-SPAN has been providing gavel-to-gavel coverage of the House and the Senate starting in 1986 ever since. Dale Kildee has died today at the age of 92. By the way, his son Dan Kildee serves in Congress. Actor William Shatner, who played Starship Captain James T. Kirk in the TV series Star Trek, today becoming the oldest astronaut ever. He and three other crew members launching from West Texas aboard the Blue Origin's second ever human spaceflight mission.
Minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, command engine start, 2, 1.
The flight went up to 66 miles, just beyond what is considered the edge of space, returning safely to Earth about 10 minutes later. Outside the capsule, William Shatner speaking with the Blue Origin owner, Jeff Bezos.
I hope I never recover from this. I hope that I can maintain what I feel now. I don't want to lose it. It's so much larger than me and life. And it hasn't got anything to do with the little green planet, the blue orb, and the... It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the enormity and the quickness and the suddenness of life and death and the... Oh, my God.
It's so beautiful.
Beautiful, yes, beautiful in its way, but...
No, I mean your words.
Oh, my words.
It's just amazing.
I don't know. I can't even begin to express what I would love to do is to communicate as much as possible.
Hey.
The jeopardy, the moment you see how the vulnerability of everything, it's so small. This air, which is keeping us alive, is thinner than your skin. It's a sliver. It's immeasurably small when you think in terms of the universe. It's negligible. This air, Mars doesn't have it. Nothing. I mean this. And when you think of the carbon dioxide change to oxygen, and what is it, 20% or something? That level it sustains our life. It's so. Thin. Mm-hmm. To dirty it. I mean, that's another whole
And you
subject.
Shoot through, what you were saying about shooting through it so fast.
So quickly, 50 miles.
And then you're just in blackness.
You're in death.
Yeah.
The moment
this
you
is leave, life.
This is life, and that's that. And it's in an instant, you go, whoa, that's death. That's what I saw.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Wow. I am overwhelmed.
Actor William Shatner, after he landed, after the second flight of the Blue Origin mission, with Jeff Bezos, the billionaire owner of Blue Origin at the West Texas landing zone. At 90 years old, Shatner setting the record for the oldest person ever in space, breaking the record just set in July on Blue Origin's first mission, 82-year-old Wally Funk. Thanks for listening to Washington Today and for more top stories from Washington delivered to you every day. Subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word at c-span.org/connect. Have a great night.